So now, have a look at the text itself. The first verse simply says, the elder, that's the author, the elder, the presbyter, presbyteros in Greek. Well, he's obviously well known. He doesn't need to introduce himself. He's known to the people he's writing to. He's presumably an elder in the community of the beloved disciple. All this material comes from there. And it's likely that he is John the presbyter. John the elder. He just doesn't call himself John. In D8, we've got a church leader from a community writing the letter. And who's he writing it to? To the elect lady and her children. Okay, he's using a term for, he's writing to a church or to a cluster of churches that are under some kind of organisational government in the other end of town or just outside of Ephesus or I don't know where, but in the locality. And he's using the feminine term for them for fairly obvious reasons, because God is imagined as the bridegroom and the community is the bride of Christ. So he's using a polite but also a very profound kind of image, the feminine image of the mother church. And her children, he may mean the members of the church, but if he's writing to the church, it sounds like he's writing to the little house churches that have been founded from this community. So the cluster of house churches in wherever it is, the local area. So he says to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in the truth. Now if you just glance at verses 1 to 3, you can see at a glance, truth, truth, truth. There's a fourth one somewhere. Truth. So in three verses he's used the word truth four times. So we're into a term that is obviously very familiar with these people and very central to their understanding. And if you go back to John's Gospel, you'll see truth a lot, and John's letter, is the first letter of John, is full of it too. So we're dealing with a vocabulary that's very meaningful in this extended group of house churches. And I've said it to you before, truth, well, what is truth? To quote Pilate, truth is who God is as revealed by Jesus. Truth is reality that's not hidden. I've told you once, the Greek is aletheia. And lethe is the river in the underworld, in the Hades, in the Greek Hellenistic world. Lethe is that river of forgetfulness. The river that when you die, you cross it, and so you forget your previous existence, and it's all forgotten. Well, aletheia, A is a negative particle on the front. Aletheia means not forgotten, not forgetfulness, meaning not masked, not hidden, but revealed, seen, experienced, known. And what is the ultimate thing that we want to know is God. So the ultimate truth is God. Or as the first letter said beautifully, God is love. That what was revealed of God, where was it revealed? In Jesus. So it's very Jesus, it's not a theoretical, abstract thing. It's focusing on Jesus and what he reveals about the ultimate reality, God. So whom I love in the truth. He's in this truth. It's in this relationship, in this mystery, in this living communion with God that Jesus invites the whole community into. He loves the people in that place, in that truth. And not only I, but also all who know the truth. And we're back to the word know again. I'm sure you're getting more and more familiar with it. Know here doesn't mean know about. It doesn't mean answer questions correctly, though they're good things to do. It means to know, to be in communion with, to know through intimacy. You can only know in love. There's no other way of knowing. Otherwise you just know about it. It's the experiential spirit in the community binding people together. And there are things they know. And they know the truth. So he's writing in this whole Christian setting. Because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. The truth that abides in us, go back to the Last Supper, if you abide in me, I will abide in you. The truth that abides in us is, of course, Jesus, who is the way, John 14:6, the way, the truth, and the life. It's also the Spirit. And when I say also, it's a bit tricky here when you start talking about Jesus and the Spirit and the Father and use the word also. We're going into quite a profound mystery because there aren't three gods and Jesus is not the Father. This is the subtlety of the Greek mind that worked this out in the Trinitarian doctrine. And the Son is not the Spirit. But the Father is God. The Son is God. The Spirit is God. There is only one God. So you can't work that out. But you can get a bit of a... you must hold all that at once in your mind, that there is one God. But God is communion that is so complete that it is one. It's a love one. And so the Spirit is the Spirit of truth. Last Supper discourse again, three times. The Spirit of truth I will send, the Father will, whom the Father will send, you know. And I'll pray to the Father, he will send you the Spirit of truth, the Advocate, the other, Paraclete, Advocate. So it's Jesus present in the community. But how is Jesus present in the community? Jesus is not present in the community physically the way he was before he died. Jesus died. Well, that's the end of that, just as it is for us. That way of being finishes with death. And the resurrection isn't a resuscitation of a dead body. It's a person living in a transcendent way, quite beyond anything we can imagine, anything physical in the sense of this physical. Paul bears that out beautifully in his first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15, and says, first of all, it's a rather silly question. He said, you may ask, what kind of body do we have when we rise? He said, that's rather a silly question when you think of it. And then he goes on to talk about the stars' bodies and this, you know, and a seed and a tree, and he doesn't talk about a grub and a butterfly, but he could, in all the different ways. So, no, it's just beautifully beyond us. But that's what... So, the Christ, Jesus who is present to us is present to us precisely through his Spirit poured into our hearts. It's his love, life, love, which is poured into us. That's his Spirit, the love that he has for the Father, that communion of love, which is... So we experience it as Spirit. We experience Jesus as Spirit because we're experiencing his Spirit. So the truth that abides in us, you just have to hold both the recognition that it is the risen Jesus present, it is the Spirit that binds Jesus to the Father that is present. And of course, since Jesus is present and the Spirit is present, Jesus can say at the Last Supper, my Father and I will come to you and make our home in you. So the Father is present too. So the whole Trinity is living within our soul, within us. Soul's a rather a non-Jewish word because it gets the idea of soul and body, and that's bad news anyhow. We're one being. So you don't want to be distinguishing as though we're two parts stuck together. So we're a human being, we are. And in us dwells the Trinity. His wish then to these people is grace, mercy and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, in truth, here it is again, and love. Grace, mercy, and peace. Grace and peace are very common in all Paul's letters. Grace, mercy, and peace. You find in the introduction, in the greetings of Paul to Timothy. You find that also in the second letter of Peter. So we've got a very common greeting at the time. What grace, of course, means God's gracious gift. Peace is the harmony of the community and the harmony within each person in the community, the full life but in harmony. And mercy is that beautiful thing we did last sometime. Eleos means God's... It covers three concepts in the Hebrew. Chesed, which is God's covenant, promised, faithful, unconditional love, is covered by mercy. It also covers Hanan, which is, you find it in the word Yohanan, John. Hanan means all the different ways that God actually shows his love, the graces of life, daily life, the many ways in which God graciously cares for us. And it covers the Hebrew rechem, which is the womb of a woman, and by extension, comes that affectionate feeling word of affection, care, love in that sense. So all those Hebrew concepts are captured by the Greek eleos, and that's the word translated here by mercy. So it's a rich, rich greeting, love greeting to the community. Again, it's all in truth and in love. Having then greeted them, verse 4 of this pretty tiny letter says a bit of news. I was overjoyed to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we've been commanded by the Father. Walking in is perfectly Jewish, you know. Walking in the truth means living, doing it, actually doing it, not just talking about it, in the truth, which we've said enough about, just as we've been commanded by the Lord. When he says, I've overjoyed to find some of your children, there's no indication in this letter that there's any criticism of the community. So some isn't saying, but some aren't. He's not going to go on to contradict those who aren't. Some presumably therefore means the ones he's met and he's heard about. He's not generalizing, but he's saying, you know, I've met some of your community and they're really lovely people. Brackets, I hope you all are, but he doesn't know them all. So it's not a restrictive word, I think. But now, dear lady, community, I ask you not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but one we've had from the beginning. Let's love one another. I don't need to go to that, do I? The whole first letter of John was about that. And this is the love that we walk. Love that we walk. It's not bad. According to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard it from the beginning. You must walk in it. Do it. Don't just talk about it. Material that is exactly, the whole first letter is full of it. I've just got a few quotes here from other parts of the Bible, the New Testament, show you how. Here's Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians, chapter 4, verse 9. Concerning love of the brothers and sisters, you don't need to have anyone write to you. You yourself have been taught by God to love one another. Romans 13, 8. Paul, owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. He's brought the law to its fullness. That's what it's all aiming at. And you've reached the goal. First letter of Peter, chapter 1, verse 22. Peter writes, now that you have purified your souls by your obedience to the truth, same meaning of truth there, so that you have genuine mutual love, love one another deeply from the heart. And I'll conclude that little section with the first letter of John, in chapter 2, where he said, very similar to the text we're reading, beloved, I'm writing you no new commandment. It's an old commandment that you have had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word that you've heard. Yet I am writing you a new commandment that is true in him and is true in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. The commandment is as old as God. The commandment is as old as the Old Testament. But what's new is that Jesus said, not just love one another, which you can find in the book of Leviticus, and it's love one another as I have loved you. That's what's new. And it's now new because someone's actually doing it. Jesus did it. And he's letting us do it through our spirit that's still present in the community. And you know it all, he said, so do it. Walk in it. Don't just think about it. Verse 7, he then picks up the problem that we saw also in that so-called first letter of John. And there's nothing really new in it. Many deceivers have gone out into the world, gone out of the community into the world. Those who, and this is why they're deceivers, they do not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. You've got that message? From the, in the flesh is what they're missing out. Well, they're happy with Jesus Christ, all right. They're happy to fit him in, and they're happy to write some of these gospels and thoughts and send out spiritual writings to each other. But it's all feet off the ground and nothing to do with Jesus' blood, death, life, words, actions, the real Jesus. No, he came in the flesh. Any such person is a deceiver and the Antichrist. Both terms used frequently in the first letter of John. Antichrist used three times and deceiver twice, but the same terms are used of this group. That's the deceiver. That's what the Antichrist is. And John talks about it there in his first letter, chapter 4, verse 2 and 3. Be on your guard, he says, so that you don't lose what we have worked for, but may receive a full reward. This we is the community, but it's the leadership of the community, particularly what our eyes have seen, our hands have handled, the Word who is life. You know, those who've been connected with John the Beloved, or the beloved disciple, John, and they've been there from the beginning, and he's an elder, he's one of the older men in the community, and he's seeing the younger ones chuff off into these various little groups and leave the community, and he's very concerned about it. So we've worked hard for this love. Don't let it go. Here's John's Gospel, Jesus, placed on the lips of Jesus by the author of the Gospel. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for food that endures for eternal life. That's the reward. The eternal life which the Son of Man will give you. This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. And John, the beautiful prologue, goes, from his fullness, from his plural fullness, we have all received the fullness of communion with God. So that's what we've had. Don't lose it. And your reward will be, of course, eternal communion with God. He goes on in verse 9, back to our text. Everyone who does not abide in the teaching of Christ. Now, here's the word that we haven't met before in the didache. This is the famous didache. There is a book called the Didache to the teachings of the 12 apostles, which is sometime in the first century. Some put it later, but most still can take it very early writing, possibly from Antioch. But this is, that's the word, the teaching, the didache. And the noun from that is disciple, the didaskalos is to teach, and so on. Anyone who doesn't abide in the teaching of Christ, but goes beyond it, does not have God. Beyond it meaning, oh, Jesus, that's great, now let's improve on it. And so they thought they were improving on it as they went off into their mystical flights. Well, they do not have God. A little echo from John 16. I still have many things to say to you, said Jesus at the Last Supper, but you cannot bear them now. When the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth. He will not speak on his own. He will speak whatever he hears. So the Spirit is Jesus' Spirit. So they can be assured that it's Jesus speaking in the Spirit in the community. It needs discerning. But once they know it's the Spirit of Jesus, they can take it as true. The Spirit of Jesus, they can take it as true. Because Christianity, of course, is all that's old and all that's new. It's the apostles, it's also the prophets. So it's a living faith. Because God is alive, you're alive, I'm alive, and the world is constantly changing. It doesn't mean the fundamental insights change, but it means they find new words. A beautiful introductory, lovely thing, the homily that, or the speech that John the 23rd gave at the opening of the Second Vatican Council, was a glorious document. I can't remember it now, it's just flipping it to my mind. He said, though, you know, the truths of faith do not change, etc., the way they're expressed has to change. It has to relate. It has to engage the world. And that's why it was a pastoral council, not to define new truths, but to help the church reach the modern world. That's why. And therefore we have to find words that actually capture, engage and answer the questions that are being asked in a new situation, not simply repeat old formulas, which are correct. But they were meaningful in the 4th century. actually mean nothing to people today because they don't know the language or don't know the questions or all of that. So it's holding the tradition by constantly reliving it, like we do every Holy Week. Every year the ceremonies are a little bit different, please God, because you're creating them. Someone else gets a new idea. Some genius in the parish makes some beautiful new vestments. or you know, puts a cross up from the burnt wood of Canberra from a couple of months ago. You know, and that's all. But it says, it speaks, doesn't it? It's the same truth, but it's the same truth. It's reality. It's God now speaking. So he wants us not. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. So it's beautiful. And here's, no one who denies the Son has the Father, said the first letter of John. I keep calling it letter because that's what we call it, but it's not a letter. The first document we call the first letter. Everyone who confesses the Son has the Father also. The Gospel from the same community. Those who love me keep my word. Doesn't actually use the word teaching, but you can see the link. And my Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home with them. I don't like these translations, this modern. That's the New Revised Standard Version. They've made it plural to avoid him, which I understand. But as soon as you move from him to them, it becomes third person, imperson. It just feels different. I suggest, if you're translating the Bible, that if you want to get away from him, and I see good reasons for doing that, because our language teaches us. And from little boys and little girls, if we always hear male language, it's not good. So we've got to do something about it. Why not move it from the third person to the second person, rather than to the plural? In other words, if you love me, you will keep my word, and my Father will love you, and he will come to you and make his home with you. It's not identical with using the third person singular, because the third person singular isn't just addressed to the ones listening, it's about anybody. I'm not asking you to agree with me, but I just think it captures better the feeling of the singular than them does. Them loses it, in my view. That's a minor point, but I suppose language is just so important. And the letter concludes, this covering one-page letter, verse 10 to 13. This is why he's writing the letter now. Don't receive into the house. The house is the house where the house church, where the people are coming for the liturgy, for the Eucharist, for Mass. Don't receive into the house or welcome anyone who comes to you and doesn't bring this teaching. He means, I turn up at your church and I'm going to do the homily. Who the heck am I? You know, I mean, I'm some heretic from somewhere around the corner. Wait a minute, keep this careful. I don't mean you're standing up in a pulpit giving it. It's a community, but welcoming in as a teacher. I mean, if they want to come and enjoy our communion and say how wrong they were and they'd love to belong to us, of course, he's the last one to want to keep them away. He's talking about welcoming this wandering teacher who's actually got it wrong and is heading the church off into Gnosticism, early Gnosticism, whatever. So don't welcome them. To welcome is to participate in the evil deeds of such a person. If you welcome them, well, they're preaching error. They're not preaching that Jesus came in the flesh. They're not teaching about the crucifixion. They're teaching, and my God, there's plenty of this today now that I get onto it, they're teaching success Christianity. They're teaching some other kind of thing, militant Christianity, but they're not teaching humility, they're not teaching love, they're not teaching the mystery of God, they're not teaching respect, you get me? So in the name of Christ, shocking things are being said. Well, he's saying to the community, because this is new to that community and it's busted the community up already, as we saw looking at 1 John, warning them, don't welcome them. Say, I'm sorry, thank you. We're not welcoming you to preach in our community, to be part of this teaching effort. Although I have much to write to you, I'd rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk with you face to face so that our joy may be. The children of your elect sister, so he's calling perhaps this is the mother church that he's the leader of, one of the leaders of, but he calls himself a sister. In other words, he's writing as one among equals. You're chosen. Elect means chosen by God, chosen in love, all of that choice word. Send you their greetings. So my commentary on that is that the elder, the presbyter, John maybe, his name could be, but we don't know from the letter, but tradition says his name was John. The elder judges the ideas and methods of the schismatic teachers so dangerous that he advises the church not to offer them the hospitality which they would normally give to travelling missionaries. This is a way of telling them that they are not teaching with the blessing of the Mother Church and that they are not to be received as Christians in good faith. To offer them hospitality is to welcome their teaching and to give them another platform in the house church for disseminating their erroneous and dangerous ideas. And that is the end of this second letter of John.